ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Continuing with the discussion of understanding and applying Srila Prabhupada's teachings. First of all, Krishna Kirti Prabhu, you can please summarize in 10 minutes or so what was discussed yesterday.
So yesterday we introduced the seminar with a very common phenomenon in religions, which is namely schisms, that there are differences in among followers of any particular religion. And some examples of this are, within our own society, are defections to other Gaudiya Mats, Ritvikism. There are other different kinds of splinter groups and so forth like that. And we see this in other religions. In Christianity, you have the Catholics, and you have the Protestants, and then you have very many lesser-known sects that split off. Some sects, just like they had Vatican II, 1962, 1965. That was a time when the Catholic Church was reassessing its connection with modernity and modern people. And so some people, they wanted to stay with the Catholic, they wanted to keep the old Latin Mass as it was, and they didn't go along with it, and so they kept to themselves. And they were branded heretics. In fact, in America, the Puritans who came to America from England, the famous Puritans, they left England because the Church of England, the Anglican Church, would not let the Puritans practice as purely as they wanted to. So this is a very common thing, and ISKCON is no exception. Russian Orthodox Church was mentioned also. Old believers, they decided to keep practicing the old Orthodox, the old religion, as it had been practiced before, and they became known as the Orthodox, and they were also persecuted. So most schisms, another point, they're generally not over money, power, possessions. Our immediate experience is the Gaudiya Math. There was very much splits that occurred in the Gaudiya Math after Srila Sarasvati Thakur's departure. Those were more prominent than they often are in these things. They usually form over ideology. In the Western experience, the very famous case is that of Martin Luther. He actually went to the church and he nailed 95 theses on the church. These are, theses, these are certain points or certain truths on which he differed with the Roman Catholic Church at that time. So sometimes there's split over seemingly minor issues. One instance of this is nuns, women's liberation, and so forth. The lady celibates in the Catholic Church, many of them, fully embraced modernity. And this came into conflict with the Roman Catholic hierarchy, and ever since then there's been some conflict between them. So, another interesting case that was discussed yesterday was about chocolate. So the some of the Srila Prabhupada, he came out on a number of occasions.
Didn't cause a schism yet.
That would be a pretty interesting schism if it did happen.
Difference of opinion.
He said that cocoa and chocolate are not to be taken because they're intoxicants. And then in another time, Prabhupada said, if it's not intoxicant, then it can be offered to the deities. Another disciple of Prabhupada recalled how Prabhupada, he actually took some sandesh that was made with chocolate and took some more. He asked for some more of it. So what the incident or the case of chocolate shows is that Srila Prabhupada sometimes says different things or does different things at different times that seem to be contradictory. And because they're contradictory, if you try to reason just on that available evidence on what Prabhupada said or did, you can come to contradictory conclusions. So because you can come to contradictory conclusions in this way, it is sometimes the case that it is inadequate simply to quote Srila Prabhupada. So this brings us to the some observations from some academics who study ISKCON. One of them is Dr. Thomas Hopkins. So Dr. Hopkins, he noted that in ISKCON is that the method of reasoning or arguing about these different issues is mainly based on taking Srila Prabhupada's statements as found from this program called the Veda Base. Perhaps sometime later I'll say more about the Veda Base. I think it's one of the worst things that happened to ISKCON.
That's a heavy statement. I think we can have a schism over that.
I really do believe we are having schisms over this.
Yeah.
But there's so what happens is somebody comes and they say, well, for some controversy, they collect all the Srila Prabhupada quotes and statements that they think supports their position. They blast it out on the internet and say, I win. Then the opponent does the same thing, all the quotes that support their point of view, blast it out and says, I win, and it keeps going on and on and on like this. So Dr. Hopkins mentioned that this is just like you see in different fundamentalist Christian and Muslim sects, that they're also arguing the same way, and you don't reach a conclusion because the evidence is all in the same level. There's no distinction between higher, lower evidence, precedents, and so forth. And therefore, he explained that there's some need for having some exegetical principles, some sort of principles of exegesis that allows you to correctly understand what is the intention of the authority. So this is a very important point. Another point related to this is the that we also discussed is the qualification of the guru. One of the qualifications of a guru is not only must he have full faith, but he must also be shastra yukti. He must be an expert in the shastras. So Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Nectar of Devotion, talks about three classes of devotee: your Kanishta Adhikari, your Madhyama Adhikari, and your Uttama Adhikari. So the Uttama Adhikari is one who he has full faith in Krishna, and he is also an expert in the shastras. So his faith, his shastras, his quoting shastras is a testament to his faith. Sometimes you have people who are expert in the shastras who they don't have full faith, and they're trying to get around some precept that they don't like or deny it or refute it. In other words,
is that book available?
It's supporting their faithlessness rather than faith. So faith is important.
Maybe tomorrow.
Actually, it's the most important characteristic. And then there's the his expertise in the shastras. So the Uttama Adhikari, he is able to meet any challenge. He's able to you know, with a Shastra, he's able to defend himself and defend others against any kind of challenge. He's able to explain the Shastras, and he's able to explain the Shastras in terms of both his experience and, you know, with reference to other Shastras and so forth. He's able to satisfy all doubts. He has no doubts, therefore he has firm conviction. Then you have your Madhyama Adhikari. Your Madhyama Adhikari, he has faith, but he's not expert in the Shastras, and therefore, even though somebody might come and he might counter him and he might say that he might not be able to defeat the person or defend himself or others against that, even though his faith still remains intact. Then you have the Kanishta Adhikari. So the Kanishta Adhikari, he has neither solid faith nor expertise in the Shastras. So therefore, when someone comes along and he presents some other conclusion according to Shastras or opposite conclusion, his faith is swayed, sometimes it's broken, and so forth, like that. So for creating spiritual masters, it's therefore very important that we be creating Uttama Adhikaris. So there's a whole program to do that. There are different ways of doing it, not unlimited ways, but there are different ways of doing that. And so such a spiritual master, he is also conversant in these exegetical principles. So it's a part of the education of creating a bona fide spiritual master, a qualified spiritual master. And then we had some more discussion about Dr. Hopkins's quote. He was talking about how in ISKCON, just the absence of these exegetical principles at practically all levels means that we just... The kinds of controversies that we're dealing with, they stick with us when they could have been settled long ago if these exegetical principles were in place. So therefore, what this seminar is about, it's an introduction to these principles, how to understand Srila Prabhupada and so forth. I can give like a very simple example why this is important. Say, for example, we talked about Shastra being the center. Okay, so Shastra, there's a letter that I don't have the quote with me right now, but it would be, it's in the letter, the Srila Prabhupada was writing to one of his disciples. He was praising him about the Brahmacharini Ashram. And he says, very nice, I'm glad to hear it's very successful. He says, but it is better that the ladies be married, you know, to a good husband. He says, if good husband cannot be had, then it is better to live like this, like a Brahmacharini, even though it's a little difficult, but it's still better to have a husband. So you can interpret that statement in a couple different ways if Shastra is not the center. So how would you know whether this is meant to be a temporary measure or a permanent measure? You could say, well, Prabhupada, he created a Brahmacharini ashram. That's his innovation. He's qualified to do that. So now we have a Brahmacharya ashram. That's a new thing. Or this is a temporary measure. We're supposed to move towards a standard where that ashram is not needed anymore. You have the husband, father, son taking care. And we get the clue when Shastra is a center, because Srila Prabhupada, he mentioned Shastra. He mentions Manusmriti as being the source of that. Then we understand that this is the standard we're supposed to follow. So we cannot follow it now because of some asamartya or some inability. But when that is no longer the case, then we follow what the Shastra says. So Shastra, making Shastra the center of all, it allows us to discern more clearly what is the actual intent of the author. So the author, in this case, the author, you know, comes from the word authority. The authority, gurus, and authority. So another understanding of Shastra's the center is that the there's two Bhagavatas. One is a person Bhagavata, and one is the book Bhagavata. And the person Bhagavata is a Bhagavata because he lives his life in terms of the book Bhagavata. Therefore, that's another way to understand how Shastra is the center. Otherwise, what does it mean to be a Bhagavata? Because he follows the book Bhagavata. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. So that brings us to this evening's presentation by Sripad Bhaktivikash Maharaj.
Okay, I'll continue. Thank you. What's being presented here is really cramming in a lot of stuff, which really requires to be dilated upon in a lot more detail. But due to lack of time, just going through very briefly. And there are all kinds of issues. Just like you say, Shastra is the center. Then what do we accept as Shastra? We accept Shastra as center. We only accept a guru because he follows the Shastra. But sometimes we see things that Srila Prabhupada has given us, which are not according to Shastra, but which we would not change. For instance, the dress of a brahmachari is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam 7th canto. He holds a stick, he has a mekhala, some kind of waistband, and he's not dressed in orange or in white or even in cloth. That's something we're not going to change. We accept it as a Srila Prabhupada, following his guru, instituted the dress code for brahmacharis as we have it now. So that's just a small instance. But there are so many instances. Then there are so many points to consider. Also, that question arises, can the guru make a mistake? This question was put to Srila Prabhupada by Jayadvaita Brahmachari, who is now Jayadvaita Swami, who himself is, for the last several years, has been at the center of a controversy surrounding what is called the book changes issue. If we take Shastra for ISKCON as being most important Srila Prabhupada's books, what constitutes Prabhupada's books? If Srila Prabhupada said there's a planet of the trees presided over by Aryama, it must be right. Right? Did Srila Prabhupada say that? Well, it was... Anyway, it goes on and on and on. But one time, Jayadvaita Swami asked Srila Prabhupada, can the Acharya make a mistake? And everyone else who was there on the morning walk, they looked at him like, as if by looking, if they could burn him up by looking at him, they would have done so. But then Srila Prabhupada explained that the Acharya's perfection is not that he doesn't make a mistake. For instance, Srila Prabhupada's usage of English would be considered mistaken by any standard textbook on English, and Srila Prabhupada himself knew that, which is why in the beginning of his Srimad Bhagavatam presentation, he quoted the Tadvag Visag Namanya, what is that? Abhadavatyapi, even if not properly presented, it is grinanti. What is that? Gayanti, shrinanti, grinanti, gayanti, sadhava. It is heard, sung, and accepted by, and here Srila Prabhupada translated sadhava as purified men who are perfectly honest. Very interesting translation. So, I recently spoke with Jayadvaita Swami. I was discussing him, saying to Srila Prabhupada about mistakes, and I said to him, actually, it's a very good thing you asked that, and it's recorded, and it's in the Veda base. And I'm glad it's there. Because it's a very important question. But it raises the question that, okay, it's accepted that the Acharya might make technical mistakes. And Srila Prabhupada explained that his perfection lies not in the fact that he's not God in the sense that he doesn't make, that he's all-knowing and perfect in all respects, but his perfection is that he teaches the Shastra as it is. And he may make some technical mistakes, which opens up a whole nother can of worms, which is an English saying, which another whole kshetra, a whole field of discussion of, well, maybe we should accept the Acharya's spiritual instructions, but not necessarily his material instructions. And there are problems with that because the Bhagavatam and the whole Vedic culture, it's all intertwined. For instance, the Varnashram system is for dealing with the material world, but it's completely intertwined with the Vedic culture. It's completely intertwined with everything that's described in Shastra, just like this morning we were reading about Brihaspati and Tara, and Brihaspati is the guru of the demigods, Indra is a Kshatriya, Brihaspati is a Brahmana, and so it becomes very difficult to disentangle. Anyway, I'm just speaking on these topics tangentially, just to give the idea that there's, once we wade into this topic of praman, or what is evidence, what is authoritative, it's actually the in philosophy, in Western terms, it's the beginning of philosophy, epistemology. How do we know anything, and what do we accept as valid knowledge? And you could get stuck right there and not do any more philosophy and spend the whole of your life just arguing and trying to understand what is valid knowledge. And that's the beginning of any Vedic philosophical system also. We find that Tattva Sandarbha is the first of the Sandarbhas of Srila Jiva Goswami, in which he establishes the the teachings of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam. And first of all, that first volume of these Sandarbhas is on Praman Tattva. What do we accept as valid evidence? So huge, huge topics we're getting into, and we just have to skip over them to some extent. And that's also one major reason, as I understand, that why we accept a guru. Because a guru is supposed to be Shabde Pare Chanishnatam Brahmanya Pashamashrayam. He's supposed to have dunked himself or become immersed in the knowledge of Shastra and to have completely taken shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, it's also not possible for any guru or acharya or any human to know everything in all the Shastras. Therefore, again, Jiva Goswami brings us to Srimad Bhagavatam. At least one should be conversant with the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is Sarvaveti Itihasanam Saram Saram Udaharitam. It is the condensed essence of all Shastric knowledge. and then becomes a very big topic, who do we accept as guru? And you can see that there's plenty of grounds for plenty of opinions. One way to approach this massive diversity or possibility for diversity was given by one of the most, maybe the most, no, not the, Anyway, a prominent religious figure of Bengal in modern times who said, Joto mat toto pot. Whatever opinion you've got, it's okay. Let's not fight. You think this, I think that. Okay, you think that, and I'll think this, and we'll just shake hands and we'll tolerate each other. There are problems with that also, because for Hindus, killing cows is the word sacrilege, and in Islam, it is required. So it becomes a problem. Well, anyway, we're all followers of Srila Prabhupada, so it should be fairly straightforward, isn't it? We all have the same instructions from the same Prabhupada. Why can't we all just agree on everything? There was one Jesus, and so many different ideas about how to follow him. So what we're dealing with here, it's not just doctrinal issues or applying logic and reasoning, but there's also psychology at work. Psychology, we understand from Vedic sources, what's going on in between the ears, it's not just some interaction of neurons stimulated by sensory stimuli. But we have attitudes, impressions, attachments, and conceptions which have been formed not only in this life but in many previous lives. We are advised to come before the Guru as a blank slate. Don't bring our own ideas, but that seems to be, that's the ideal, but that seems to be practically impossible, seeing as we do have so many different things already deep in our consciousness. As I was saying this morning in a talk I gave this morning, that two people may see the same thing and have a completely different reaction to it. Again, I can give that example of beef. A Hindu, if he sees or hears of a cow being killed, traditionally any Hindu would be shocked and outraged. Whereas for a Muslim, you think, oh, very good, it's a festival. So two people may see or hear about the same thing and have a different reaction to it according to their preconditioning. So we're talking about psychology also. Here's a quote from William Blake, who was an English mystic, if there could be such a thing. He wrote, common quote from William Blake, both read the Bible day and night, but thou readest black while I readest white. I guess you have to know English to get that, and have to know English fairly well to get the point. But the point is that what he's saying is that different readers of the Bible, they read different things into it. And to give an example of this, there he is, William Blake, got the date also. There is a much cited quote in Srila Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrita commentary, which I just came to my mind now to quote this, so we don't have it for the screen, in which Srila Prabhupada talks about how one cannot change the customs of a country immediately, and therefore we have made this policy of engaging both boys and girls in preaching, and the results have been wonderful. That's not an exact quote, but it's pretty close. You probably know it. He's good at remembering all these things. So some people read this and say, yeah, there you go, that's it. We should engage the boys and girls in preaching equally, and the results are wonderful. And others may say, you cannot change the customs of a country immediately. So that gives the idea that actually Srila Prabhupada did want to change it, but he wasn't able to do so immediately. So therefore he made a policy which was not necessarily for all time. And then you can bring in the discussion that actually Srila Prabhupada wanted to introduce Varnashram Dharma. You all know about that? Everyone knows about that? Srila Prabhupada wanted to re-establish Varnashram Dharma. Are you all aware of that? How do you know? You read it in Srila Prabhupada's books? Is it? Do you hear it spoken in classes at all?
Yeah.
You do?
It's been a recent topic because in Ramayana, which has been the recent topic, it's mentioned a lot in the purport.
It's mentioned a lot in the Ramayana.
In the purport.
Where are you talking about? In America?
No, here in Mayapur.
Oh, here in Mayapur.
Uh-huh. Section where Ram's pastimes are summarized,
Varnashram is mentioned quite a bit. Yeah, that's in Srila Prabhupada's purports in the ninth canto. It's especially in the last few years when Srila Prabhupada was present among us, he spoke a lot about Varnashram, the need to reestablish that. Although even before he came to the West, we can see from his pre-1965 writings, he was also talking about re-establishing that. So there's an example of how from the same teachings different people reach different conclusions. And you gave the example of Martin Luther, who was the father and mother of so many schisms, the major schism in the away from the Roman Catholic Church. He introduced a new doctrinal approach to Christianity, that faith above works, and we accept the Bible with no interceding party, no, what did he call it? Priestcraft. Which sounds like witchcraft. No one in between. There's you and Jesus and the Bible and that's it. Yeah, ever heard anything like that in ISKCON? There's you and Prabhupada and his books and that's it. But Martin Luther's protest, which gave rise to Protestantism, that arose not immediately from doctrinal issues, but because of the misbehavior, perceived and widely accepted misbehavior, of the priests and the popes. So in ISKCON also we have Ritvikism, Martin Luther's rejection of the Catholic Church arose originally not from its doctrines but from its practices, but then he presumed that the mispractices must have arisen from a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation of what Jesus actually wanted. And we have in ISKCON also our, they say it's ISKCON, Ritvikism. Now, if you read Srila Prabhupada's books day and night, all your life, you'll never come up with any idea of Ritvikism. But it was when it was seen that gurus in ISKCON were falling down, it was presumed that Srila Prabhupada could not have wanted this. And therefore, he must have wanted something else, although he didn't say that or write it, but he must have wanted something else. So this was an instance of presuming to understand Srila Prabhupada's intentions based on what we would say is, here on this side of the fence, is a misapplication of Srila Prabhupada's teachings and desires about gurus, and one or two quotes are taken here and there out of context, and everything else that Srila Prabhupada said about this is explained away. So the idea comes first and then the interpretation comes later. Do you get the point there? It's not that you see what are all of Srila Prabhupada's teachings on this and then you try to understand what he wanted, although actually there was no problem to understand what Srila Prabhupada wanted until ISKCON gurus, some of them, many of them, started to wobble, shake and fall. But this whole idea was made up invoking Srila Prabhupada's authority, supposedly, but the idea came first and the interpretation, then Prabhupada was pulled in to support it. There are many issues which are divisive within ISKCON. For instance, what are the social roles of women within ISKCON? Acceptance or non-acceptance of homosexuals. Hare Krishna. How about this one? Tomorrow is Advaita Acharya's appearance day. He has a beard. He doesn't have a beard. He has a beard. He doesn't have a beard. Which statement is correct? He has a beard. Well, just go downstairs and look. He has a beard. And all the pictorial representations of Advaita Acharya that were made for the paintings of Chaitanya Charitamrita under Srila Prabhupada's direct supervision portray Advaita Acharya with a beard. So how can I say that Advaita Acharya doesn't have a beard? This question came up before the installation of the five big fellows down there. And Jaipataka Maharaj raised the question that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says that Advaita Acharya doesn't have a beard. The Bengali word is dari, for beard. And that word comes in Chaitanya Bhagavat, and it states there that Advaita Acharya's dari was flapping as he danced. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur commented that this doesn't mean a beard, it means the hairs on his chest. So does he have a beard or doesn't he? Chaitanya Bhagavat appears to say so. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati denies it. Srila Prabhupada always accepted iconic representations of Advaita Acharya. Yeah, pictures and then the Panchatattva deities. The first deities of the Panchatattva that were installed in ISKCON were in Hawaii in very early, I think it was 1969, something like this. So what do you do in such a case? Ultimately, I argued for a beard because I said, well, that's how Srila Prabhupada saw Advaita Acharya. And Jaipataka Maharaj, there were different factions in this. And Jaipataka Maharaj was saying, that, look, what are all the Gauriya Mutts going to think of us? Anyway, it went off okay so far. But there's an issue which it's very difficult to settle clearly on the basis of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra when Srila Prabhupada appears to contradict his own Guru, who appears to contradict the Shastra. I'm not going to say contradict, because Guru never contradicts Shastra in essence. But there may be, if we see like that, just like when Jayadvaita Maharaj asked Srila Prabhupada, that what if we see the Guru makes a mistake, and Srila Prabhupada said, I'm paraphrasing, he said, he doesn't make a mistake. We should understand that he is Shabde Pare Janishna Tam Brahmanyu Pashama Ashrayam. He is immersed in Shastric knowledge and realized in that, and therefore what he states comes from a different platform of understanding altogether, which we may not be able to understand. Therefore, we should accept what the Guru says. And that makes things very easy. What makes it not so easy is when we have an institution with many Gurus. And even in Ritvikism, they may think that, well, we only have one Guru, Prabhupada. But naturally there are disagreements between them also on doctrinal issues and all other kinds of issues. All kinds of issues. Should gurus be appointed, there is, and there probably will continue to be, a somewhat strong current of protest against the GBC policy of no objection to persons being devotees within ISKCON initiating. They don't go so far as to endorse anyone, but there is a whole system by which someone, if they want to initiate in ISKCON, or someone wants to be initiated by them within ISKCON, there has to be a whole process of appraisal of their abilities, if they're suitable for that post. And at the end of that process, if they get through it all, they will get a no objection certificate. Not approval, because the GBC doesn't want to approve someone because they're afraid they might turn out to be not so good. So there is a undercurrent of protest that this is not according to Shastra. Anyone can initiate. There shouldn't be any ecclesiastical, as Srila Prabhupada uses that term, a guru should not be accepted in terms of ecclesiastical procedures, something like that. On the other hand, ISKCON has to decide, or as an institution, it would seem to make a lot of sense that ISKCON has some control over who represents them in this very important function. Otherwise, any nutcase can just start initiating. And actually, there has been at least one nutcase widely recognized as a nutcase who disciple of Srila Prabhupada in ISKCON, who started initiating, but something seriously wrong up there. And so he was de-guruized pretty quickly. It may be also that someone's not a nutcase, but he may have serious doctrinal or personal differences with the broader body of the institution. Running an institution is not an easy thing. There's no doubt about that. Within Vedic culture, maybe we could say, or within Hinduism, if we want to use that word, maybe the first institution in modern terms was the Shankaracharya's instituting mutts, or mutt monastery is something of a, but it's more than a monastery, because it's the the mud that the Shankaracharya established, they are meant for doctrinal authority also. So within each mat, the system is there's a matadipati, the head of the mat, sannyasi and head of the mat, and he's something like the pope within that. Whatever he says goes. So that's one system. Within the ashtamat, later formed by Sri Madhvacharya, they have eight mats, which are all representing Madhvacharya, and they have a system set up by Madhvacharya of twinning. Two mats go together with each other. So the same system, there's a sannyasi at the head of the mat. But if the sannyasi at the head of a mat passes away before he's appointed a successor, then the twin mat may appoint a successor. In this way, continuity is supposed to be ensured, and actually has been over hundreds of years. Now, that system rests on one guru at the top. Srila Prabhupada instituted ISKCON, in which the GBC should oversee everything. Not that there's one guru and who is the ultimate authority, but the GBC is the ultimate authority. Srila Prabhupada actually criticized his godbrothers in the Gauriya Math, who he said, after Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur passed away, he had said to have a GBC for a managing body for overseeing all the affairs of the mart. But the followers of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they decided, no, we need one acharya. So Srila Prabhupada said that this was a mistake that they made. And from the when the first appointed acharya had serious problems, left the mat, and that the idea that there should be one sannyasi in charge continues to the present day, and when one follower of a sannyasi passes away in any given mat, and the followers, they don't all agree with him, and so some may go and make their own mat, and in this way there are more than 40, we say the Gauriya Math, but there are more than 40 branches and sub-branches at the present time. various issues which are on the table at the moment, hot issues at the moment within our ISKCON society. Should disciples initiate in the presence of their gurus or not? Traditionally, it seems to be in the norm. It's there in Hari Bhakti Vilas. There's indications that Srila Prabhupada was strongly against it. Seems to be a need for it at the present time. So there are pros and cons. Another big issue at the present time is, should women initiate? It's a pretty straightforward one, isn't it? I mean, on the spiritual platform, everyone's equal, so it's a no-brainer, right? Definitely, women should initiate, and only people who are misogynistic, women haters, they will oppose this. It's clear, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't it? Anyone? Then the question may be raised, well, why is there a strong opposition against that from within ISKCON also? Why? There's a whole bunch of women haters and we may ask then why did Srila Prabhupada, when he had named 11 to be the first Ritviks who later became gurus, Why were they all men? Why did Srila Prabhupada not make any GBCs or town presidents men? Why did Srila Prabhupada repeatedly quote that women should not be given any authority? Is the whole Vedic culture misogynistic in giving a subdued social role to women? These questions arise. So it may not be so straightforward as saying that, well, we're all equal on the spiritual platform. I'm going to backtrack a bit here, and I want to get onto that issue, but there is something, a few important things which should be discussed. Before that, getting back to Ritvikism. Okay, put up the great Ritvik quote. This is a quote from The Final Order, a book written by Krishna Kant Desai. According to the Ritviks, you shouldn't read any other books except Prabhupada's books, books written by demons like, for instance, Bhaktivikasa Swami. They're all poison. So only read Prabhupada's books, because everyone else is contaminated and they're not on the same level, but The Final Order is okay. So here's a quote from The Final Order. Although there actually was no final order of Prabhupada, there wasn't that Prabhupada, his last order was said, okay, Ritvikism. There's no such thing. It's an imagination. Anyway, you can kindly read the quote. And you can read it there also. This is called selective quote. I don't think it's even selective quoting, it's just imagination, that's all. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, so, quote, the important point is that although the Ritvik system may be totally unique, it does not violate higher order Shastric principles. It is testament to Srila Prabhupada's genius that he was able to mercifully apply such Shastric principles in new and novel ways according to time, place, and circumstance. Unquote.
Okay, give a 5-minute demolition of that.
Okay, so I just want to back up to a picture here. So I'm sure everyone can, many of you can guess what's going on here. So somebody's picking something red. They're not cherries, but they're supposed to be cherries, or it's supposed to be conveying the idea of cherries. So it's the idea of cherry picking. So
explain what cherry picking is. You always have to remember that most of the devotees that we're speaking to when we speak in English are not native English speakers.
So cherry picking, so in the cold weather countries where we have lots of cherries,
Cherry is a kind of fruit, for those of you who may not know.
It's a kind of fruit.
We really have to get down to the...
So it's a very nice kind of fruit.
I don't think so. Schism, schism. Don't accept anything he says. I'm the guru. Cherries are not nice, the guru said. So if you like cherries, then there's something wrong with you. Your whole spiritual life is ruined. Go on.
So what this conveys is the idea that you're picking the ripe ones and you're leaving aside the unripe ones. You can see there's an unripe berry up there. And so this means that you're actually selecting different quotes or different sources or different things according to your convenience or your purposes. So... sometimes it's like going to a cafeteria. I'm just going to take all the things that I want to eat and I'm leaving aside all the others. So in Vedic tradition, this is not permitted, or it's not proper. And the reason it's not proper is because we as the person, it's assumed, prima facie, that we are not liberated people. So therefore, we're choosing according to our impurities, our impure desires. So, and just in a little bit, Damodar Prabhu is going to talk about...
Maybe not today.
Maybe not today.
There's another session tomorrow, hopefully.
Yes. So, the many years ago, when Ritvikism was a hot topic of debate in ISKCON, we had... one of our chief complaints was that the persons for the Ritviks, for Ritvikism, they're doing exactly this. One example of this is there are certain letters of Srila Prabhupada where he cautioned his disciples not to take their own disciples. Like one is a Chutananda. So you're not ready yet. You know, we want to prepare Acharya. There's another disciple that he warned, you know, it's now's not the right time. When you know, the etiquette is that in the presence of your spiritual master, you bring disciples to him, and then in his absence, you may accept disciples without limitation. This is the law of disciplic succession. this is a famous letter, and in the final order, you will find a refutation of that letter, and the refutation is that, well, how could Srila Prabhupada have wanted to appoint somebody who is so unqualified? So therefore, they interpreted it, or subsequently, that letter was interpreted as benign misdirection. Srila Prabhupada was actually guiding an ambitious disciple away from becoming a guru. Therefore, we can discount this as evidence. So, this is an example.
Can you explain that a bit more? In other words, the disciple had a strong desire to be a guru, and Prabhupada knew he wasn't qualified, so he told him, you can do it later, but actually he didn't want him to do it.
Yeah.
At all.
So this is what
That's the interpretation.
That's the interpretation that was given. So this is what Maharaj was talking about. That first the idea comes, and then you get the evidence, or you interpret the evidence through the idea. So you filter the evidence. This evidence is not admissible. Or for example, the
is that door open? Could you please close it? It's closed.
Yeah. Maybe I'll speak louder. So, so other evidence. For example, previous acharyas gave directions on what to do if a guru deviates. You know, for example, there's in Srila Prabhupada quotes Mahabharat in Srimad Bhagavatam when Bali Maharaj is rejecting Shukracharya. He says, "Guru vapyaliptasya karya karma janataha." Utpatam pratipanasya parityagyo vidhiyate, that if a guru, he is on the wrong path, he's arrogant, and he doesn't behave in the right way and so forth, then he's fit to be given up. Now, Srila Prabhupada, he said many times, and you'll find it, many times that Srila Prabhupada said, Guru must be liberated. So this is another case. There's another letter from to Mukunda, June 10th, 1969. Prabhupada says in that letter, in response to Mukunda's, now Mukunda Maharaj's query and for Anishta Goshti about the spiritual status of the Guru. And in that letter, he says that a Guru must be Siddha. He must be a resident of Goloka Vrindavan. Very clearly, he says that. So now you have a conflict here. And so the Ritviks, you know, they reason that, well, you know, this Prabhupada couldn't have wanted this person to be a guru. So therefore, they start interpreting this way. They start filtering this evidence. And the reason this filter was so powerful is because of these other statements of Srila Prabhupada. How to understand those? So here, because the Ritviks, they only adhere to Srila Prabhupada's words, they do not accept any of these other acharyas because it conflicts with the idea they've already built up around Srila Prabhupada, they conclude that it's not relevant, you can't use it, you're jumping over Srila Prabhupada, and so forth. So we conclude that Srila Prabhupada's creating something new. And this is the Ritvik system. But as we will see in this seminar, this series, that this is actually an illegitimate conclusion.
Mm. So here it's stated that the Ritvik system is unique. It's never been seen before. Which gives the idea that it doesn't conform to Shastra. But it claims that it does not violate higher order Shastric principles. In other words, there's nothing we can find in the Shastra about this, but there is some higher order, which we can't find it, but it's higher, so we can't find it. But it doesn't violate that, and it doesn't say which higher order Shastric principles, because there aren't any. But they give this idea that actually there's nothing in Shastra about it, but it's not. Actually, it's not against Shastra. So, stating this, you could bring out anything, isn't it? If you say, well, we're going to introduce, or Srila Prabhupada wanted to introduce this. He didn't explicitly say it. No previous acharya has introduced this. There's nothing in Shastra about this, but it's Prabhupada's genius that he didn't say it, but we understood it, that it doesn't conflict with higher order spiritual principles. Well, that's the reason we have Shastra, to make everything clear, and we have, if it's not clear, then the acharya clarifies it. And if you say that, well, actually, this is, we've come up with something, we didn't come up with it, it's actually Prabhupada, we can understand when he said that, I want all my disciples to initiate. He didn't really mean that. Or he was just encouraging his disciples who are ambitious. But the real thing that he wanted was this Ritvik system. So on the basis that actually it's not something that Srila Prabhupada directly said, or there's not anything that we can find in Shastra, it's not in any tradition, but we understand it's according to higher order Shastric principles, on that basis, you can introduce practically anything, isn't it? And that's why there's Shastra to tell us what to do. So you can see there's a big problem in this, isn't it? It's speculation, posing as something that Srila Prabhupada wanted. There's another similar quote like that, nothing to do with Ritvikism. Can you put that one up?
So this is another, this quote here is from a old correspondence that was had between the ICC, I believe that stands for ISKCON. ISKCON Continental Committee.
No, it's Indian Continental Committee.
Indian Continental Committee.
Leaders of ISKCON in India.
Leaders of ISKCON.
At that time
ISKCON,
were grouped under the ICC.
And also between the GBC's women's ministry, because this is, you'll see the date here, 2004. So there is some issue regarding compliance of certain rules newly adopted by the GBC at time, you know, for compliance. That, you know, the basic complaint was that, you know, ISKCON India is not in compliance with those rules. So I was a researcher on the ICC side at that time, and so I was privy to this correspondence.
There were some rules that were introduced that women should have equal opportunity to lead kirtans, give classes, and this and that, and the Indian leaders didn't want to accept that.
Yeah, so that's, I was trying to be more delicate about it. But so this is, so let me read this statement here. So what happened, you know, the context of this is that myself and another devotee, we had written a paper on Varnashram, you know, what our conception of Varnashram was. And both of us were actually at kind of opposite ends of this. You know, we had different ideas, but so our idea was, okay, let's work together, let's see what we can agree on and present that. So we presented that, and this was the response from the women's ministry side. They said, quote, Vedic life, as extolled in our scriptures, is highly interpretive. Understanding what is truly Vedic is elusive. Srila Prabhupada taught us about Vedic society and the role of Varnashram in elevating society, but he did not, practically speaking, engage his spiritual daughters within such a system. They were active preachers, pujaris, cooks, etc. Srila Prabhupada, in fact, introduced a new model with new standards, one based on preaching. End quote.
Again, saying that Srila Prabhupada introduced something which he didn't explicitly say, that I'm now introducing a new model of Varnashram. Is there any statement of Srila Prabhupada's like that? With Ritvikism, I'm now instituting a new system of initiation. He didn't say such a thing. Why do the Ritvikvadis say it? Because they don't like the present system of initiation that's going on within ISKCON. So Varnashram, Srila Prabhupada spoke about it many, many times. You can't avoid it in all the shastras. He said he wanted to reinstitute that. But here it's saying that Srila Prabhupada introduced a new model of Varnashram with new standards. One based on preaching. But actually Varnashram society is not based on preaching. It's a social system. How people eat, sleep, mate, and defend. How they live in this world. But Varnashram means eating, sleeping, mating, defending, and dharma. So this is another example of, because the persons involved, the devotees involved, were not happy with the Varnashram as Srila Prabhupada taught it, and particularly one major factor in that is that the role of women is different to that of men. They didn't like that. And so they came up with this and saying the Vedic life is highly interpretive. Yes, Srila Prabhupada interpreted it for us. It's gone off the screen. So understanding what is truly Vedic is elusive. And then Srila Prabhupada spoke about it day and night. It's elusive, but we have understood. It's elusive, but we have understood that Srila Prabhupada actually wanted to make a new kind of Varnashram based on preaching. So that's another example of not liking what Srila Prabhupada said or what he instituted. And Prabhupada couldn't have instituted or wanted his disciples to be gurus because look at what a mess they made of it. So he couldn't have wanted it. And Srila Prabhupada couldn't have wanted traditional roles of men and women in Vaishnav society because we don't like it. They don't exactly say that, obviously. There have been a lot of discussions on various issues like this. It's one thing we're talking about schisms, and they can be highly acrimonious. Acrimonious means bitter and nasty. Just like getting back to Christianity, I was raised in the Roman Catholic tradition, and in the school I attended, we were taught that the kids in the other school down the road, they're all going to hell because they're Protestants. They don't accept the Pope. And no doubt in the Protestant school, they were taught that the kids, all of us, we're going to hell because we're Catholics. Sounds silly, doesn't it? When we've been given such a high teaching by Srila Prabhupada, but we have the Ritvikvadis who openly state that the ISKCON gurus are all demons. They're usurping Srila Prabhupada's position. So it's the very, very heavy statements are there. There is a word in English called misogyny and misogynist. I learned it when it was first applied, when it was applied to me, it means a woman hater. This was said about myself because I don't agree with certain ideas about women's roles within ISKCON that other members of our society ascribe to. Srila Prabhupada, many of his statements by modern standards, present-day standards of political correctness, if you don't understand that, well, you can look it up on the internet. It's an important term in modern-day thought. Srila Prabhupada's, many of his statements and many of the statements of Shastra would be considered sexist. Sexist means to discriminate, usually means to discriminate against women as being inferior, lesser, worse, or whatever. I gave a whole seminar, actually, over 3 days a few years ago called Vaishnavism is Sexism, with many, many quotes from Shastra, just to, not to argue whether it's right or wrong either way, but just to show that if we are to accept the Shastra and Vedic culture as it is, and the whole body of Srila Prabhupada's statements as they are, then according to modern or present-day ideas of political correctness, then Srila Prabhupada and Vaishnavism and the whole Vedic culture is sexist. And actually in Bhagavad Gita as it is, right in the first chapter, Srila Prabhupada makes a statement that women are not to be given freedom, not that they're to be treated like slaves, but they're less intelligent, they're like children and this and that. And there was a private conference among scholarly devotees of ISKCON called VAST, which means Vaishnav Advanced something or other. Advanced Studies and something like that. Yeah, kindly put off your phone, whoever's got it on.
We have a quote from Rochford.
Yeah, I'm getting to that, yeah. So, on that conference, someone who was on that conference leaked it out because they were outraged by some of the statements that were being made on there. We're talking about some of the prominent, well-known leaders in ISKCON who are on this conference. There were statements about one of the members of the conference openly stated that Srila Prabhupada, I can't accept Srila Prabhupada's sexist statements. And also wrote about Lord Ram very blasphemous things because of what was perceived as his mistreatment of Sita. Now this was leaked, and some, myself among others, brought a complaint to the GBC. The GBC considered, two GBCs resigned over this. Then they got reappointed very quickly because it was openly blasphemous to Srila Prabhupada and to Lord Ram. The protest went on, what are you going to do? You have to remove these persons from ISKCON. You can't allow blasphemy of Srila Prabhupada and Ram within ISKCON. Anyway, it went on for months and months and months. Ultimately, nothing happened. There's a whole chapter about this chapter within a book called Hare Krishna Transformed by E. Burke Rochford, whose academic career has A large part of it has been based on studying ISKCON, and we're going to now have his quote, what his analysis of this whole situation was. Srila Prabhupada questioned. That's Burke Rochford, Santa Claus. Doesn't look like a typical, what you'd think a typical scholar might look like. But anyway, go on.
quote, the doubts raised about Prabhupada's authority resulted in a number of angry and hostile reactions that soon found their way to ISKCON's leadership. As one ISKCON leader described it, the virulent tone of the response approached, quote, the ancient atavistic mob cry, burn the witches, unquote.
Atavistic gives the idea of cavemen with clubs. In other words, those who are angry about this were a bunch of savages. That's the idea given.
Despite the outcry from GHQ members and other devotees equally concerned about the challenge to Prabhupada's authority, ISKCON's North American leadership made no formal effort to sanction or otherwise stop those responsible for defaming Srila Prabhupada. As one prominent GHQ member declared, quote, these GBC men did not rise to defend Srila Prabhupada. They did not rise to come to the defense of those who were trying to defend Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah, so what actually happened was the Prabhupada was being blasphemed. His authority was being challenged among a group of devotees, some of them very prominent in ISKCON. This was brought to the GBC, and as a neutral, in his own understanding, well-wisher, scholarly observer of ISKCON noted that the GBC, they did not rise to defend Srila Prabhupada. And there's another quote, is it continued? They did not rise to defend Srila Prabhupada. Yeah, go on.
Quote, there also is evidence suggesting that at least some of ISKCON's North American leaders tried to quietly disassociate themselves from Prabhupada's controversial writings about women, given the movement's past history of abuse. As one GBC member acknowledged, Prabhupada's statements are, quote, under currently established norms of business, government, and academics, labeled sexist and regarded as on the same moral level as anti-Semitic or racist utterances, unquote.
So E. Burke Rochford has analyzed that ISKCON leaders want to disassociate themselves from Srila Prabhupada's statements. They don't like them. They don't believe in them. They're not prepared to defend them. And in this way, Srila Prabhupada's authority... There's another quote still. Do you have that one where it says that Prabhupada's... Yeah. There's another quote from Rochford. Krishna bless his soul. Where it says that Prabhupada's authority... Prabhupada's no longer accepted as... His words are no longer accepted as authoritative. But do you have them here?
Right there.
Okay, put them up.
Continuing on, quote, the debate about women's roles and place in ISKCON led to critical questioning of Prabhupada's scriptural commentaries as well as to his overall authority as Krishna's pure representative. The fact that the leadership failed to act decisively on Prabhupada's behalf was an acknowledgement that his authority no longer was absolute, unquote.
So there we have that Prabhupada's, from ISKCON leadership, when Srila Prabhupada speaks on women's roles, it's not absolute. According to an outside observer has thus observed. This has very deep ramifications, does it not? When we're discussing such things and making decisions, or when our big leaders are doing so, they don't accept Srila Prabhupada's statements, which are of course all based on Shastra and Vedic tradition, they don't accept them as ultimate or absolute. Or they cherry pick. They'll take some quote and neglect the others. This is going on. It's not just my opinion, but it is the observation based on as much as he can be objective observation by an outside scholar. Is there anything else?
There's one more.
There's one more. Yeah, go on. Oh yeah.
So he finally concludes. He concludes the chapter with this with this statement. The conflict over gender equality, incited by the GHQ's determined effort to assert traditional Vedic conceptions of Dharma,
opened. The GHQ means myself, Basu Ghosh, Shamasunda, Krishnakirti. We're the four leftovers from that. And there were others also, but others have faded away. But we've been fighting all this for more than 20 years now. Schismatic.
So the conflict over gender equality, incited by the GHQ's determined effort to assert traditional Vedic conceptions of Dharma, opened a Pandora's box that may forever remain open.
This is a bit difficult unless you're good in English, but it's really consequential. It has serious consequence. Opened a Pandora's box that may forever remain open. I heard something recently. Someone said that, well, we don't care what the GBC, let them make whatever mistakes they like, and later we'll see it's a mistake, and then we'll correct it. Tell that to the people of Hiroshima. Some mistakes are correctable. Sorry, made a mistake. We won't do it again. Oh, only one more time. Go on. Okay.
The debate about women's roles and place in ISKCON led to critical questioning of Prabhupada's scriptural commentaries, as well as to his overall authority as Krishna's pure representative. The fact
Read that again.
The debate about women's roles and place in ISKCON led to critical questioning of Prabhupada's scriptural commentaries, as well as to his overall authority as Krishna's pure representative.
If you don't like what Prabhupada said, this is from an outside observer, if you don't like what Prabhupada said, his scriptural commentaries on the role of women, then what do? You don't accept his authority. This is mainstream in ISKCON. No one's going to openly say, I don't accept Prabhupada. Well, some of them do. I'm not going to accept Prabhupada on this, but this is what is actually going on. Go on.
The fact that the leadership failed to act decisively on Prabhupada's behalf was an acknowledgement that his authority no longer was absolute. Given ISKCON's increasingly pluralistic membership, it was perhaps inevitable that Prabhupada's teachings would be questioned, especially in light of their past misuse resulting in the abuse of devotee women and children. As one ISKCON leader expressed it, quote, there is irreducible diversity within ISKCON. It is a mistake trying to find the straight line. What is important is whether a devotee fits within the boundaries of Prabhupada's teachings, unquote. Yet as these teachings become reframed as guides for thought and action in place of being absolute truths, traditionalism will continue its march to the margins of ISKCON. As it does, the goal of creating a viable cultural alternative to mainstream American culture will cease to exist. Unquote.
ISKCON is meant to make an alternative to the materialistic society, is it not? Have you all heard that? Where did you hear it? Any recent classes? We're supposed to change the world, establish Varnashram, make a Krishna conscious society. the goal of creating a viable cultural alternative to mainstream American culture will cease to exist. I'll speak about that tomorrow, Krishna willing. If it doesn't get stopped, which is possible, it has happened before when I've said I'm going to speak on such things and orders come from above. Don't let him speak on this. So, yeah, we may continue with this tomorrow. Mancha kalpa tarupyas chakripa sindhubi eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha.